Coming up, a special episode of the Ideas Lab podcast, What It Means to Be, presented by Dr. Yan Wong.
Hello and welcome to this Ideas Lab Predictor Podcast special edition on what it means to be ethical. We've got four guests here, so let me maximise your pleasure and minimise their pain by introducing them right now. Marcus Belbin is a campaigner for fair and ethical trade.
Hello.
From the University of Birmingham School of Health and Population Sciences, we have Dr. June Jones, a bioethicist.
Hi.
And Dr. Jonathan Shapiro, a health services researcher.
Hi.
And finally, we have Dr. Sheila McGuinness from Birmingham Law School.
Hello.
Nice to meet you all. Now, I think ethics can sometimes come over as rather distant and theoretical unless it impinges on you directly. What do you think are the most important ethical issues facing us right now in the UK? June?
I think we're recording this in the midst of a whole range of scandals. And so I think the most important ethical principles for me are around trustworthiness. That if we can trust people, then we can trust them to tell us the truth, to keep promises towards us, to be fair towards us. And those three issues, truth-telling, keeping promises and being fair, seem to be key themes in all of the situations we're dealing with at the moment. Scandals in hospitals, in policing, in education, in politics. They're the key issues. And to me, if people are trustworthy, then that resolves some of the ethical dilemmas that we're dealing with.
Jonathan?
It almost feels that society's done a U-turn. If you go back 40 or 50 years, then the assumption was you could trust everyone to do everything and we were all in things together.
Yeah.
And the sort of move towards the me-ism of the 80s and 90s means that people are very self-interested and much less prepared to give of themselves to society, and that's led to a reduction. Yeah. And I would add things like the banking scandals, for example, is another very important one. So I'd agree with June.
Do you think they were actually trustworthy 40 years ago, or do you think it's just a perception that people had?
I think there's always been, at the margins, there's corruption and people are very self-interested. But the norms, the cultural norms, I think, have changed. And there is a sense that, whereas before you were sort of innocent until proved guilty, now in trustworthy terms, you're guilty until you show that you're innocent. Think of welfare, for example.
Marcus?
I feel like the biggest challenge is a lot of people feel powerless in the face of things happening to them, these sorts of scandals that are happening on a regular basis. But there are things we can do, and I think it's really important that we know and recognise, are aware of the problems, and are aware of the things we can do to make a difference, to influence the people around us, to be fair and ethical.
Sheila?
Yeah, I'm not sure people have become less trustworthy, because I think the difference is people are less deferential now, so they're more willing to question things, and that may uncover stuff, but if you're powerless to do anything about it, then that is kind of frustrating. So on the one hand, we have inquiries in hospitals and policing, and we find out that there are bad things happening, but at the same time, there's not a massive amount that people feel they can do about it. So in the wake of the Liverpool discussions about the Liverpool care pathway, and I'm not agreeing with necessarily the content of the report that came out, but or the Staffordshire inquiry, one of the things that seemed to be most difficult were families who felt they weren't being listened to in those situations. So talking about how they try to speak to somebody about the treatment their relative was getting. And
the Liverpool care pathway being that one where an end-of-life pathway, basically, that you're put on. Yeah, well, we've actually got some vox pops. We've gone out and asked people what they thought were some of the most significant ethical issues facing Britain. So we can listen and see what people say.
Colour is not an issue, and the same goes for age, etc. It's not the way you look; it's what's inside that's important.
Things along the lines of immigration and the British public's xenophobia at times.
I think immigration is going to be an enormous time bomb.
Most tax is means tested, yet the bus pass for the elderly is not means tested.
War? What is the whole point? Because what are you really going to get out of it? It's just going to be more people dying.
The environment.
Respect. Respect for one another, respect for different races, different religions.
Discrimination.
Inequality.
The issue of how the press behave. You'd never, ever, ever want to move towards censoring the press, but they can behave in societally reckless ways.
There's loads of discrimination against colour or your background. I think we just all should be treated the same.
That's quite interesting, because they didn't quite pick up on what we were saying here, did they? There was talk about discrimination, immigration. racism, that sort of thing. But
well, I think that's not entirely true in terms of powerlessness for change,
right.
Which is perhaps something that I noticed they picked up on colour and racism. Mm-hmm. And certainly in Birmingham here, we have a big tradition both of both racism and also of challenges to racism. Going back, Henry Gunter, a big campaigner, the colour bar was in Birmingham. These sort of changes, they require us to take action. And if we sit back and let these things wash over us and say, oh, we can't do anything about it, then these things will carry on going. And I think it's really important that we do stand up when we see inequality, when we see problems. So those people speaking there, it's very important that their voice is listened to, and also that they're given the opportunity to, that we are given the opportunity to influence.
I think when people say race shouldn't matter or colour shouldn't matter or we should treat everybody the same, it's not quite true, because these things do matter. If we treated everybody the same, which is what traditionally we have done, then people have had inequalities of health. People have less good access to healthcare when we treat everybody the same. Mm. Black and ethnic minorities do poorer in terms of health outcomes, in terms of educational outcomes. So actually what we want is positive discrimination. We don't want to be treating everybody the same at all.
It's a thorny issue, positive discrimination, isn't it? But it's one that should be talked about, I think.
So you're talking about equity rather than equality.
Absolutely,
And people often get the two muddled up.
Yeah.
Equality means the same for everyone, but it often is very unfair because they don't need the same.
Yes.
Positive discrimination makes it feel sort of too much the other way.
Yeah.
And then for me, there's something around the political correctness agenda. And once you start talking about things that are headlines, the good thing, you often get into real difficult and sort of squirm territory where they're quite difficult to enact.
I guess there might be a bit of a problem here with setting baseline ethical standards, because that might mean that you end up being less ethical than you would be otherwise. I guess there must be cases of this in medicine where you're trying to hit particular targets which are seen to be ethically good, but where maybe you end up with a system that isn't doing the best for people.
Well, generally, I mean, people are quite complicated, and if you try and prescribe everything at a sort of micro level, it's bound to go wrong. Whereas if you have the sort of the ballpark is about right, and you let people some flexibility within that, then they'll usually do the right thing.
And you're hoping that people will usually do the right thing. You're sort of an optimist in that respect.
When we were talking before we came on air about the difference between regulation and aspiration, and for, my philosophy, if you like, is you start with aspiration and you back it up with some regulation, but you don't start with regulation, because immediately the people feel constrained and punished and treated like children. You have to treat them like adults and then be prepared, if it goes wrong, to back that up with a stick, but it's carrots first and stick second.
Do you think that would work for the banks, for instance?
Even with the GMC, if you think of them as historically, they had a self-regulatory approach, and they're not really a body that self-regulates anymore.
It's the General Medical Council.
I'm not so convinced self-regulation will always work. I think there's a difference between trusting the discretion of professions and, but the idea that you allow aspirations, I guess it presumes the dominant norms are going to be the right ones to begin with, and that's just not always the case. I mean, banking's a good example of it, but certain aspects of medical practice, the dominant norms about, say, clinicians' views that they may know best in each situation, you know, we now recognise that probably isn't true, because medical decision making isn't just medical, it's holistic, and you take into account different aspects of people's lives. So I don't know, I think it depends on what your view of regulation is, but the idea that it's always very harsh or it has to be punitive seems to me not to be true.
I see that as the difference between free trade and fair trade, in the sense that free trade opens up boundaries and in principle is equal. Everyone is equal. Everyone can trade without the barriers that are put in place by governments and other bodies, which would give very large multilateral businesses a distinct advantage in the world. Whereas fair trade is taking into consideration particular situations across the world and treating people fairly, rather than a situation where everyone is equal.
But it's never entirely free, is it? And it's never entirely equal, because you set up a ground rules for how the system works, how the capitalist exchange system works, that means that multinationals in these cases probably do have an advantage for whatever reason. But there's a whole set of laws that they have to abide by, monopolies laws and all sorts of things that get the best outcome for everyone, aren't they?
We have cases in agriculture in this country of people coming across in Warwickshire and other areas quite close to us, where slave gangs effectively are operating in the fields that we locally produce food. There's the cockle pickers in Morecambe Bay. This is happening in this country right now, and we turn away from it. The word slave, I think, very, very often is removed from articles, and the term immigrant, or the certain language around it, which some people in the media are more comfortable with portraying these stories. We had a case just next to the university not so long ago, Cuddles. I don't know whether you're aware about that. A big sex trafficking story. Well, I think there were 19 women were pulled out of a situation. There was a shotgun on the premises. There's barbed wire around it. From I don't know how many different countries, a number of different countries these women were. And the way it was portrayed in the media and the way those women were treated, partly because of the way the law situation is in this country, was not fair. They were not treated as slaves, even though that's exactly what they were.
To play devil's advocate here, though, you say that the law's not working, but surely it should work on the sort of percentage of cases. It can't possibly be expected to catch everything. But as long as the sort of ratios of numbers of slaves is going down, or numbers of people in these situations, then surely the law is more effective than it used to be.
Well, how effective is the law? I mean, that is a tricky one.
It seems to me that there are two different issues, though. So one is the multinational exploiting a lack of local regulation, right? So they're exploiting the fact that there aren't protections in place that there would be in other countries. Now, that seems to be slightly different than trafficking cases, which are where you have criminal gangs that are purposefully ignoring the laws. With regard to trafficking, we do have laws in place. And yes, law is going to, in some senses, have to catch up with evolution of criminality, right? So as gangs become more organised. But I think the existence of crime doesn't mean that law is a failure.
As I understand it, though, because they're being categorised as, I mean, this is something perhaps you'll know, I hope you'll be able to answer, is they're being treated as immigrants is very different from being treated as a slave, a victim.
I'd need to know more details of the case, because there are certainly trafficking laws. If an individual is here from another jurisdiction, then I mean, I don't think I could even comment, because it would really depend on the particulars of the case.
Back to the absolute relative thing. So if we had the boss or some pharma company, would they be rubbing their hands and saying, I'm trying to do everyone out of things? I mean, they're driven, they would think that they have a positive intent. Yeah. How do things change? What gives it a flavour? And can you regulate people into an ethical stance? Mm. Or does it have to be something that is in the air?
I guess one difficulty is always going to be between the particular case and general rules, right? And if you have general rules that apply, and this is why laws can sometimes seem unfair, a rule can be generally applicable, but in particular cases lead to a circumstance you don't think is good. That is a problem that you'll always face.
But I mean, we do talk about multinationals, we group them together, and somehow we do have this image of them being as bad guys. And my guess is if we had them here, they wouldn't say they're bad guys. And what are their ethical drivers, and how are they different, and what's the difference?
There's the wider question that Jonathan was bringing up there, which is, can you be ethical if you are entirely profit-driven? Can you set up the system such that the outcome is ethical, even though the drivers are not necessarily ethical?
It goes back to what we were saying before, and trust and so on, and short-term versus long-term. Mm-hmm. If you look at the very successful companies these days, their working conditions are really comfortable, and there are very few pressures on them, and it's a very aspirational milieu. But there are relatively few people, so they can, you know, if people are stepping out of line, then there's a sort of the flock can bring them back into line, and they get a lot more productivity out of them. Mm-hmm. They're there 15, 18 hours a day. You can argue whether that's a good thing or not. Whereas if you take a very short-term thinking company, then everything is done by the book, and they may get productivity high in the short term, but they get very poor staff loyalty and very high staff turnover and sickness absence and so on and so forth.
Which employees are you talking about, though? Because it might be that certain sections of their staff are nurtured and encouraged.
But we need to have that reflection about the NHS, don't we? What is what are the drivers for change there terms of ethics?
I've done a lot of work on the health service, and what you see is that most people go into the health service at whatever level because they are value-driven. They want to do good by patients. And certainly speaking for senior professionals, doctors, nurses, they could earn a lot more money doing other things, but they're getting much more from doing the right thing around patients. And the drivers in the last 20 or 30 years have been very financially, economically driven, and that's affected their attitudes. And now we're talking about how you can sort of I've got a saying I use quite a lot, the floggings will continue till morale improves, and we're trying beat them to get their morale back, and that doesn't work. You need to grow that back, which is back to my point about aspirational ethics. You need to allow the doctors and nurses and people who are doing that to do what they feel is right, not just because they're told to, but because it's room for their professional judgments.
It's very much the cold face of ethics, isn't it? The sort of medical profession, because there are people living and dying on the basis of the decisions that you make. And you have, presumably, there are ethical frameworks, very carefully written down ethical frameworks that people have to abide by for the NHS.
Well, there certainly are, but it takes us back to this problem between regulation and aspiration. So the frameworks that are written down are regulatory or guidance, and all they're doing is setting the minimum standard, the standard at which if you fall below, you could end up with claims of negligence or criminal activity. They're just setting the lowest common denominator.
But is that true for things like, I don't know, the Hippocratic Oath or something like that? There are surely...
The Hippocratic Oath is so problematic in today's society.
So not specifically the Hippocratic Oath, but the guidance, the various bits of guidance that the GMC gives.
Duties of a doctor.
Yeah, and those are aspirational rather than...
I just think the regulatory...
If you look at the content, the GMC is quite rules-based in their good medical practice. But if you look then it's something like the Nursing Midwifery Council's guidance that is quite aspirational. Personally, I'd rather be regulated by the GMC guidance because at least the rules are clear. Whereas when it is an aspirational code, that might inculcate... I mean, I think there's, again, and this goes back to exploitation in different countries, is it the case that in every instance they treat all their staff that well?
That's a good point. But they probably set a contract with a Chinese company and leave the internal management of that company to them.
Is that unethical of Apple to do that?
Once they know... Then at an ethical level, not just a legal or economic level, they should change it. Whether they will on the basis of ethics, that's really the big question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit like the NHS constitution, right? The idea that if we make lots of aspirational statements, it's going to somehow make us all feel better. I think what needs to happen in the NHS is a much greater structural change and a move away from, yes, target-driven medicine, but also even if it hasn't been a private company, at least since the early 90s, it has been motivated by costs and lower cost of care provisions. That seems...
But there are financial implications, obviously, for running the NHS, and so presumably someone would argue, the people who manage it would say that we have to take the costs into account and we have to get an ethical framework that incorporates those as well so we can get the best results.
You've got a basic difficulty. It's a level of regulation, I think. Yes, I'd agree. You obviously have to have some clear rules. It's the question of how far you drill down, because professionals, whether they're lawyers or doctors, are about judgments. They're not just about following the rules. And the moment they can only stick to rules, it becomes reductive and it's going to miss the point. So you have to find a way of allowing them to exert judgment within some sort of regulatory framework that allows professional judgment to work. And if it becomes reductive, you get an NHS 111. It's all done by paper and algorithm, and it doesn't work. Doctors can completely mess up the NHS extremely easily without breaking any rules at all, just by writing different prescriptions. You need to have them on board. You don't have them on board by flogging them. You get them on board by encouraging them and rewarding them and understanding what drives human nature.
But I don't think good medical practice guidance, I don't think just rewriting it or making it more aspirational is going to change the morale in the NHS.
Well, it's about the word aspirational. I agree with you. Manhood and apple pie isn't enough. But it's that the end point is doing the right thing rather than the end point is sticking to the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the existence of GMC good practice isn't the reason the NHS or morale is low.
I agree.
I think that the structural issues that have reduced morale are above and beyond the kind of guidance codes for the professionals. They're about larger structural issues within healthcare provision and changes to...
There's chicken and egg. I think you've seen... I mean, every time there's a problem now, they introduce another rule which actually makes things worse.
But they're systems rules, right? So there's a difference between saying we have an ethical code to guide the professions and we have kind of structural and systematic
governance. If you take the GMC, and again, I don't know the detail, but if you look 50, 60 years ago, the GMC, bad medical practice was sleeping with your patient. And no one actually looked at clinical quality at all, because that was seen to be purely the professional domain, the domain of the individual. And yes, you could be taken to court, but that was it. And all the crises of the last 30 or 40 years have forced the GMC to become much more of a micromanager in the clinical area. And it's not just doctors. In fact, by reputation, the doctors are much harder on themselves than the lay members of the GMC are when you actually come to the when they're sitting around the table. But the risk is now at a micromanaged level. When there is no room for risk, there's no room for judgment, and you then get a very litigious culture, very risk averse. There's no such thing as a judgment, over investigation, and a very American style of healthcare, which isn't good health.
And do you think it's unethical to have such a system?
Personally, I think it is.
But with regard to the litigiousness, I mean, the evidence suggests that we aren't more litigious. We think we are, right?
So than what?
So this idea that the UK has become very Americanized in its approach to litigation and healthcare is a myth. And it's a myth that we encourage because we all talk about the rise of litigation. But actually, if you drill down into the evidence, the amounts of damages being awarded and the number of cases, there hasn't been this exponential rise in the way that people think.
No, but when I was a GP, and I've not been a GP for some years, the average GP would have one complaint in his career. The average GP has a complaint live at any one time now. So the number of people who are complaining, back to this, we're not deferential anymore. And that's not a bad thing. But the culture has changed, and we've just got to be careful that doesn't put us on the back foot. And we're just doing rule-bound medicine to protect ourselves, because a risk-averse system isn't what a good medical system should be.
So we've been talking a lot about doctors and medical professionals, but do you think most people who are listening to this, for example, are acting ethically in their everyday lives? Do you think people are driven by a desire to do the ethically right thing?
I think people need to be, both professionally and personally, aware of what influence, what effect they're having on the world around them, and to make ethical decisions on what they buy as consumers, for instance, what decisions they're making in the hospitals, a whole raft of things that we can do to make our lives more ethical and to influence others to make sure that we are
treating people fairly. And you're optimistic that if you give them that information, people will act ethically?
Yes, I am. I don't think that has changed, and I hope that more access to information can only improve that in the future, as long as people are aware of it.
Does everyone here think that this is something that will improve over time? Will people with more information, will we end up with a society that is even more ethical than it is now?
I think we're seeing, it goes back to the very beginning discussion about perceptions of control. I think there's been an increased dissonance. We've been told that we have control over all our lives as individuals, and actually we're feeling more and more powerless on the bigger stage. And that dissonance, I think, is driving quite a lot of unethical behaviour. So the answer is to try, not necessarily give more control, but to more congruence between our expectations and reality. And if we actually felt the degree of control that we are allowed and the degree of control that we can exert are more or less the same, then we'll probably behave in a relatively consistent way. It's when the two are at odds with each other that you get inconsistent behaviour.
Yeah, it seems like one of the most important things that I think would encourage ethical behaviour is reducing inequalities. So if there are large gaps in kind of educational attainment and wealth, all of those things, that will encourage unethical behaviour, because it does seem to kind of make some people feel less powerful and others maintain their power. So, and we're uncovering all of that, but it seems like every time we find out about these things, then a study tells us, well, actually, BME attainment in university isn't quite what it needs to be yet. And we know that salary outcomes, the gap between the highest and the lowest is getting bigger, it's not getting smaller. And these seem to me to be, of course, it's very easy to talk about people should act ethically, but actually, if your day-to-day reality or your lived reality is conditions in which you can never be the person who does well, then of course you're going to act unethically. Like, it's going to be easier to shop and wherever has the cheapest offers, or, you know, it becomes very, it's just, that's your reality or whatever.
Then there's a whole series of hard-won battles because I think you do have to fight for these things. You can't just allow it just to happen, that have happened through the last century and are carrying on. Mm. You know, most people know what fair trade is now. They didn't 10, 20 years ago. In terms of rights, you know, women have the vote. A whole range of equality for gay and lesbian rights. All these things are in legislation, at least, improving. And I think certainly in terms of the culture of the country, possibly, I would argue that there have been improvements in terms of fairness and ethical treatment of people in this country.
I think to improve ethical behaviour, we would need to see people become less selfish.
Will that happen?
And so in terms of education, it's not just about educating people about what's available. It's about some self-reflection, about the selfish drive that we've all got. Mm. I think ethics and selfishness are incompatible.
An interesting note to end on. Marcus, June, Jonathan, Sheeda, thank you very much.
This Ideas Lab Predictor podcast was presented by Dr. Yan Wong and produced by Lucy Vernal and Sam Walter. It's part of a series from the University of Birmingham.